I'm Donald MacLeod, and thanks for downloading this highlights version of Composer of the Week. There's information on all the music you'll hear, as well as our terms of use, on the Radio 3 website at bbc.co.uk/radio3. It was the enticing prospect of the car that clinched it. Rachmaninoff had a passion for speed on land and sea. There had been talk of a tour of the United States for some years, but he told a friend he really didn't want to go, not at all. But by 1909, established as a successful composer and conductor in his native Russia, with a wife and daughters to support, the prospect began to seem more appealing. The Americans were offering a lot of money, and with all that cash, Rachmaninoff would be able to buy himself a really smart set of wheels, a fast set of wheels. "I'd like to buy an automobile. I can't tell you how much I want one," he told that same friend. So he signed the contract and sent it back to the agent. Now the longed-for car could become a polished, gleaming reality. The work whose widespread fame earned Rachmaninoff that lucrative American contract was this, his prelude in C-sharp minor. That grueling American concert tour saw Rachmaninoff play 20 concerts in the span of 6 months, 19 as pianist and 7 as conductor. Amazingly enough, given how famous he was as a performer, this tour included the novelty of Rachmaninoff's first ever completely solo recital. It's clear he found the experience physically and spiritually crushing, but he clung on to that automotive dream. We don't know what brand of car it was that Rachmaninoff eventually splashed out on with his American earnings, but it's possible it was one of Carl Benz's machines. Thereafter, Rachmaninoff bought a new car every year or so for the rest of his life. Shortly before he left New York, a journalist asked him about that famous prelude. "Under the circumstances," he said, "I should be thankful that I wrote the composition, but I am undecided whether my oversight in neglecting to secure international copyright for it was altogether fortunate for me. Had I copyrighted it, I might have had wealth as well as fame for it." That's a characteristic Rachmaninoff remark. Despite his rather lugubrious appearance, he always had a wry sense of humour. Well, this week, my focus is going to be on Rachmaninoff in the United States, where he eventually settled, reluctantly to begin with. Though he lived there for most of his adult life, he was always homesick and never properly learned to speak English. Also typical of Rachmaninoff was a deep-rooted sense of insecurity about his own talents. Shortly before he embarked on the US tour, he wrote to his friend Nikita Morozov, "I'm perpetually dissatisfied with myself. Nothing but continuous torture." Rachmaninoff was also always secretive about any new projects he was working on, and he kept under wraps the fact that he'd composed a new concerto for himself to play, his third piano concerto. The first performance with the New York Symphony under the Polish-born conductor Walter Damrosch was greeted rather tepidly by the critics, likewise the second performance shortly after. But the following month, Rachmaninoff performed the concerto again at Carnegie Hall, this time with the New York Philharmonic and their new music director, Gustav Mahler. And this time, the critics responded more warmly. "The work grows in impressiveness upon acquaintance and will doubtless take rank among the most interesting piano concertos of recent years, although its great length and extreme difficulties bar it from performance by any but pianists of exceptional technical powers." Thank you. Towards the end of his life, even Rachmaninoff refused to play that concerto and preferred to entrust it to younger men like Horowitz and Walter Gieseking. Rachmaninoff found quite a lot to dislike in the United States. A month into the tour, he wrote home to his cousin, Zoya Privitkova, "In this accursed country, where you are surrounded by nothing but Americans and the business they're forever doing, clutching you from all sides and driving you on, God give me patience. Everyone treats me kindly, but I'm horribly bored with it all, and I feel that my character has been quite spoiled here. Sometimes I grow as angry as the devil, and I have 2 more months here." On the other hand, he was impressed by the attitude of some of the orchestras he worked with, above all, the New York Philharmonic. After a thorough rehearsal of Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique, Mahler rehearsed them in Rachmaninoff's concerto. "Though the rehearsal was scheduled to end at 12:30, we played and played far beyond that hour. And when Mahler announced that the first movement would be rehearsed again, I expected some protest or scene from the musicians, but I did not notice a single sign of annoyance. The orchestra played the first movement with a keen or perhaps even closer application than the previous time." Reviewers had commented on the deep vein of melancholy which pervades much of Rachmaninoff's music, which he performed on the tour. A plaintive Russian note wandered through all this music. In fact, towards the end of the programme, many of the listeners began to feel as if they were prisoners bound for Siberia. Another reviewer, also noting how Rachmaninoff's music is weighted down with melancholy, which seems to be racial in its insistence, commented on how, in his valedictory concert, it was natural that this composer should turn with a sort of gruesome delight to so congenial a subject for his inspiration. The subject was that inspired by a haunting painting by the Swiss artist Arnold Böcklin, The Isle of the Dead. Rachmaninoff admitted, once he'd seen the original, that he preferred the stark black and white of the reproduction he'd originally been drawn to rather than the muted colours of the actual painting. Rachmaninoff said The Isle of the Dead was a dream picture which should produce such an effect of stillness that anyone would be afraid to hear a knock at the door. Before he left the USA, Rachmaninoff was offered the post of conductor of the Boston Symphony, but the prospect of long absences from Moscow struck him as appalling. There were offers of contracts for a return visit the following year, but Rachmaninoff brushed all these aside. On his return to Moscow, bored, tired, and exasperated by the whole experience, and in particular having greatly missed his wife and daughters during those 3 months, he gave an interview which would seem to explain some of his reasons for declining those offers. "America was a strain. Imagine giving an almost daily concert for 3 whole months. He exaggerates there. "I played only my own works. The success was great. They forced me to play as many as 7 encores, which is quite a lot for that audience. The audiences are extraordinarily cold, spoiled by the tours of first-class artists, and forever looking for novelty, for something they've never had before." Though he didn't know it then, Rachmaninoff would be returning to America on a one-way ticket. Politics would see to that. The winter of 1916-17 brought Arctic conditions to Russia. The huge falls of snow seized up the railways, and food couldn't be distributed. The so-called mad monk, Grigory Rasputin, was assassinated in December 1916, and in less than a year, a series of tortuous and unplanned events unfolded which led to the downfall of the Tsar and the seizure of power by the Bolsheviks. When, in February, there was a sudden, premature Russian spring, strikers and demonstrators poured onto the streets, demonstrating for peace, against the war, for bread, against the government and its policies. On the 26th, the Imperial Guard fired a fatal volley on the crowd. That afternoon, Rachmaninoff gave a charity recital to raise money for the sick and wounded in the army. The following day, more than 150,000 peasant conscripts mutinied. The Tsar and his government were toppled. In March, Rachmaninoff played as soloist in three concerts. These were to be his last ever appearances in Russia. He performed his own second piano concerto, again in aid of the army. He'd written a set of Russian songs during this time in collaboration with Marietta Shaginyan, known as Ray, an Armenian poet and singer. He valued her intelligence, and they wrote to each other a good deal. She urged him to set better poems by modern writers. But this potentially fruitful partnership was about to end. We'll hear one of the songs Rachmaninoff wrote for her. It's called A Dream or Sleep, setting a poem by Fyodor Sologub. It tells us that in this world there's nothing more desired than sleep. Sleep has enchantments, and it has wings, wide wings, light as the midnight mist. Rachmaninoff said that from the very beginning of the revolution, he thought it badly mishandled and wanted to leave. But it was impossible. With Europe still embroiled in war, no one could cross the frontier. He saw that all he'd earned up to now from giving concerts and had invested in his family estate at Ivanovka was going to go down the drain. He began to panic. Everything around me so affects me that I cannot work, and I fear turning totally sour. He was afraid for the safety of his family, and that they would be left destitute. Everything told him it was time to leave. But how? Out of the blue came the answer to his prayers, an invitation to give concerts in Scandinavia. He accepted at once and dashed off to Petrograd to get the necessary visas. His wife and daughters joined him 2 days later, and they boarded the train at the Finland station, where Lenin had arrived just a few months earlier. Rachmaninoff was aware that he was leaving for a long time, perhaps forever. He was right. Rachmaninoff had three offers of work from the USA, two for conducting posts. The third was to give a series of recitals. He recognised he couldn't simply make a living as a composer to provide for his family and give his daughters an education. He was going to have to reinvent himself at the age of 44 in a new career as a pianist. They had to borrow the money for the fare to cross the Atlantic, and Rachmaninoff set out, in the words of an early song of his, with words by Pushkin, for another life and a distant shore. Rachmaninoff gave his first recital at the beginning of December 1918. He saluted his hosts with this. Thank you. The little Norwegian steamer Bergensfjord docked in New York Harbour on the 10th of November 1918. Sergei Rachmaninoff, his wife and daughters, made their way to the Hotel New Netherland at the corner of 5th Avenue and 59th Street, which, at 17 stories, was then the tallest hotel in the world. If, in their elevated luxury situation, they were counting on a good night's sleep, they were to be disappointed. They were aroused from their slumbers by a sudden eruption of deafening noises from the street below. There were shouts, whistles, the frantic peeping of car horns. They couldn't figure out what was happening. Maybe a revolution had broken out here in New York. In the morning, they discovered what all the fuss was about. The armistice had been signed on the 11th day of the 11th month, and the news reached New York in the small hours. The Rachmaninoffs were safe. They were warmly welcomed by an extraordinary procession of visitors: Fritz Kreisler, Joseph Hoffmann, Eugene Ysaÿe, Misha Elman, and Prokofiev, who'd also just arrived from Russia by a different route. Reporters turned up in droves. Rachmaninoff told them, "I have come to America to rest and work." He would certainly need to work, and work hard. He had debts to pay off, and that meant long hours in front of the keyboard, turning himself in his mid-40s into a concert pianist. He was swiftly signed up by the Thomas Edison Recording Company, and inevitably, this is one of the first pieces Rachmaninoff went into the studio to record. The prelude made his name and then came to haunt him wherever he went. Audiences demanded that he should play it at every performance as a matter of right. When one concert manager told him it was hoped that he would include it, Rachmaninoff told him he didn't need to be reminded to do his duty. The prelude was taken up by all sorts of people, the opening quoted by the likes of Paul Whiteman, Art Tatum and Duke Ellington. Once, Rachmaninoff was practising in a house in Hollywood when his neighbour became incensed. This was Harpo Marx, who was also practising. Harpo opened his doors and windows wide and began thundering out the first four bars of the C-sharp minor prelude. He kept it up for 2 hours. Rachmaninoff got in touch with his estate agent and asked to be moved as far as possible from that dreadful harpist. When Rachmaninoff first arrived in New York, a number of piano-making firms offered him substantial financial inducements to play one of their instruments. The one firm that didn't offer him any money was Steinway. Rachmaninoff chose one of theirs, a Model H220. Rachmaninoff gave his first recital in Providence, Rhode Island, at the beginning of December 1918. His first orchestral concert was in New York on the 12th of January 1919 in the Aeolian Hall, when he played his own second piano concerto. One critic observed that he had never seen a New York audience more moved, excited and wrought up. A couple of weeks later, he played the concerto again in Boston. The programme carried prominent advertisements for Steinway pianos, as well as those of several other firms: Brambach, Stief, Baldwin and a local firm, Henry F. Miller. Patrons were also offered suitable apparel for those going south. And the programme advised, "The ladies of the audience are earnestly requested not to put on hats before the end of a number." A remarkable review of the concert, which barely mentions the music played, declared, "No more impressive figure has crossed the stage of Symphony Hall these many years. His height nearly topped the doorway through which he entered. Obviously, Mr. Rachmaninoff lives much within himself, wears no surface moods and emotions, cultivates no manner for audiences, shuts himself from the world, except so far as his music and his playing may reveal him. He is a man in whom all things run deep and strong, devotions and ideals, passions and affections, sensations and achievement. He has given himself to music." From the piece which made this tremendous impression, the second piano concerto, we'll hear the first movement. Thank you. Rachmaninoff may have given that eloquent reviewer an impression of impassivity, but beneath the granite exterior was sometimes a mass of seething emotions. He described himself as nervous, irritable, painfully impatient. "I have no faith in myself," he told the singer Marietta Shaginyan some 5 years before he left Russia for the US. "If there was ever a time when I had faith in myself, that was long ago, in my youth." Shaginyan recalled going to see him backstage after a concert. "We saw at once that he was in an awful state. He was biting his lip furiously. His complexion was yellow. As we opened our mouths to congratulate him, he exploded in complaint. He must be losing his mind. He's growing decrepit. Better discard him altogether. Prepare his obituary. Once there was a musician, but that's all over now. He could never forgive himself," and so on. "Didn't you notice that I missed the point? Don't you understand? I let the point slip." Another of the anxieties he confessed to was over recording. "I get nervous and my hands get very tense." The programme for that Boston concert is a remarkable thing, running to more than 40 pages. Amongst the profusion of advertisements for musical instruments, men's furnishing goods, household linens, hairdressers, Brown's camphorated saponaceous dentifrice, and wallpaper fit to greet the heroes returning from the war, is one for Steinert's duo art and pianola pianos. These reproducing pianos were the hi-fi of their day, whereby a roll of perforated paper was activated by a complicated system of valves and bellows in the action of the piano. Busoni called them the cinematograph of the piano. There's a good deal of scepticism about just how accurately these various devices were able to reproduce the performances of the original pianists. But at the end of his trial session for the Ampico Company, Rachmaninoff said, "Gentlemen, I have just heard myself play." At the end of his first exhausting concert season in the USA, Rachmaninoff and his family headed for the sunshine on the West Coast and rented a house in Menlo Park, Palo Alto. The young composer Henry Cowell made a pilgrimage to see the great man, who took one of his pieces and, according to Cowell, stared at it intently for 2 hours, making tiny red circles around 42 notes, and then announcing to Cowell, "You have 42 wrong notes." Cowell plainly looked amused because Rachmaninoff said, "I too have sinned with wrong notes in my youth, and therefore you may be forgiven." After this, he evidently followed Cowell's career with great interest. The following year saw the first performance in America of Rachmaninoff's choral work, The Bells, by the Philadelphia Orchestra, conducted by Leopold Stokowski. One eminent critic was unimpressed and didn't hold back. "The music is conspicuously lacking in invention, rhythmic or melodic. The means employed are gigantic. The results are banal. It is a great deal of noise about very little indeed, and one suspects that a second hearing of it would be an indescribable bore." The Bells is a setting of Edgar Allan Poe's poem in a reworking in Russian by the symbolist poet Constantin Balmont. It isn't difficult to see why Rachmaninoff had found the poem so appealing. There was the fact that, as he put it, the love for bells is inherent in every Russian. And here was Poe's poem, which in four tableaux depict the inexorable progress of life from the cradle to the grave, using the extended metaphor of bell sounds. The radiant tinkling of silver sleigh bells, representing birth and youth, the golden bells of marriage and love, the violent, blazing rhythms of bronze alarm bells instilling terror and anguish, and finally, the iron tolling of the death knell and burial. We'll hear the golden bells of the second movement. I said that Rachmaninoff's famous prelude was taken up and arranged by many musicians. Some of these appear to have been mistaken for the composer's own work. At Christmas 1920, Rachmaninoff wrote to his old friend Nikita Morozov, "I'm sorry that the rumour about my composing a whole series of Foxtrot is untrue. I'd gladly have written them, for I like their original and inimitable rhythm." Rachmaninoff does seem to have had a genuine interest in jazz. We know that he went to the concert given by the Paul Whiteman Band in the Aeolian Hall in April 1921. He said the band was the finest orchestra of its size I have ever heard. This may certainly be called authentic American music. Rachmaninoff was very clear about his feelings about his new career on the concert platform. "I dislike my occupation intensely. For this whole time, I have not composed one line. I only play the piano and give a great many concerts. For 4 years now, I practice, practice. I make some progress, but actually, the more I play, the more clearly do I see my inadequacies. If I ever learn this business thoroughly, it may be on the eve of my death." There were a few consolations in his new lifestyle, the smart new automobile he awarded himself each year. "When I conduct, I experience the same feeling as when I drive my car, an inner calm that gives me complete mastery of myself and of the forces, musical and mechanical, at my disposal." And there were occasional treats driving other people's cars. Knowing Rachmaninoff's enthusiasm for motoring, when the pianist Abram Chasins visited him, he'd borrowed a glamorous Italian Isotta Fraschini and offered Rachmaninoff a spin. He accepted eagerly and kept exclaiming excitedly over the car's performance. When we got to Santa Monica, he couldn't hold out any longer and asked if he could drive it. At the wheel, he displayed from the first moment the same precisional coordination and rhythmic rightness of his piano mastery. In 1922, a relative asked Rachmaninoff if it were really true that he had not composed a single note since moving to America. "Oh, yes," said Rachmaninoff, "I've written a cadenza to Liszt's Second Rhapsody." We'll hear Rachmaninoff's own performance of the Rhapsody, recorded in 1919. As you'll hear, the wonderfully flamboyant cadenza hints at his exposure to jazz at the time. Routine of concert tours was, it did bring rich financial rewards, and Rachmaninoff was generous with his earnings. Having re-established contact with his relations in Russia in 1920, he sent money home to support his mother and his wife's family, the Satins, as well as several friends, including Nikita Morozov. In March 1924, he played at the White House for the first time for President Coolidge, playing on the fantastically ornate, some might say hideous, gold grand, the 100,000th Steinway presented to the White House by the firm. It stands in the East Room. The case is gold with elaborate painted acanthus scrolls and stands on three eagles with outstretched wings. As if that weren't enough, the underside of the lid is adorned with a painting depicting America receiving the nine muses. We don't know what Rachmaninoff played on this fantastical instrument, but there was a long string of encores, one of which may have been this, Rachmaninoff's arrangement of Fritz Kreisler's Liebeslied.
Thank you.
Patience, 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 and then more patience. That's the essential asset, according to Sergei Rachmaninoff, of the student who would acquire finished performance. When he wasn't actually performing on the concert platform, Rachmaninoff was forever practicing. If you want a horse to win a mile race, train him to run a mile and a half. One must play a piece 1,000 times, making 1,000 experiments, listening, comparing, judging. Only through unceasing labour can the interpreter accomplish such a mission. In the talented student, the feeling for interpretation is never asleep. Though he was rigorously disciplined in his preparation, Rachmaninoff disliked and resented what his life had become in the mid-1920s, that of a full-time pianist, but he took every part of it very seriously. It's been remarked that in the recordings we have of him, Rachmaninoff often sounds as if he's improvising, although we know he wasn't. As his biographer Max Harrison has observed, the truth is that although Rachmaninoff's interpretations in part consisted of painstakingly composed mosaics of tiny details, when these were finally assembled, they might, according to the tempo of the piece, flash past with breathtaking speed, leaving an impression of instant thought. It was back in Russia, at his estate at Ivanovka, that Rachmaninoff had composed his set of solo piano pieces he called Etudes Tableaux. The tableau part of the title seems to suggest some underlying story. Although apparently Rachmaninoff was inspired by extra musical subjects in some of them, he said himself, "I do not believe in the artist disclosing too much of his images. Let them paint for themselves what it most suggests." But when Ottorino Respighi set about orchestrating 5 of the Etudes Tableaux for Serge Koussevitzky and the Boston Symphony Orchestra, Rachmaninoff supplied programmes which sound contrived and made up after the event. After 7 grueling concert seasons in succession, Rachmaninoff decided he really needed to take a year off. December the 11th, 1925, was set as the last engagement he would take on. In the seclusion of his apartment on Riverside Drive in Manhattan, he set to work on a major new composition project, a 4th piano concerto. More of that shortly. But he didn't make good progress. Rachmaninoff wrote to his friend in Moscow, apologising for not having written more often because of this accursed life here that robs one of work as well as one's whole day. I've grown used to this country, and I love it, but there's one thing it doesn't have. Quiet. Rachmaninoff bitterly regretted the lack of space and time to compose. By this stage, by his own reckoning, it had been 5 years since he'd composed anything entirely original. When someone challenged him about his lack of productivity, his succinct response was, "How can I compose without melody?" This was evidently something he considered he'd lost since emigrating from his native Russia. We'll hear next what's been called the most Russian of the works he composed in America, his 3 Russian songs for chorus and orchestra.
Thank you.
There's so much of the beautiful, ancient, poetic spirit of Russia in them that I so greatly admire. So said the conductor, Leopold Stokowski, to whom Rachmaninoff had dedicated his three Russian songs and who conducted the premiere. Those songs were the one well-received item in a concert in which they were presented alongside a world premiere. Indeed, the songs were seen as redeeming the catastrophe caused by the other piece. The music which had caused the most disastrous rout of his career was the first performance of Rachmaninoff's fourth piano concerto, the very work he'd taken his sabbatical to compose. When he'd finished working on it, he was amazed when he saw how long it was going to be. He joked to the composer Nikolai Metner that it would need to be performed over several nights in succession, like Wagner's Ring. He pointed out that since the orchestra was almost never silent, which he said he regarded as a great sin, it wasn't really a piano concerto, but a concerto for piano and orchestra. The critics gave it quite a savaging. The concerto in question is an interminable, loosely knit hodgepodge of this and that, all the way from Liszt to Puccini, from Chopin to Tchaikovsky. Even Mendelssohn enjoys a passing compliment. The orchestra scoring has the richness of nougat, and the piano part glistens with innumerable stock tricks and figurations. As music, it is now weepily sentimental, now of an elfin prettiness, now swelling towards bombast in a fluent orotundity. Pitt Sanborn's review then delivers the killing line, "Madame Cécile Chaminade might safely have perpetrated it on her third glass of vodka." Rachmaninoff was painfully aware that his music was out of step with the times. This was, after all, the decade that saw the appearance of Alban Berg's opera Wozzeck, Stravinsky's Les Noces, and Schoenberg's Variations for Orchestra. Not long before the premiere, he said, "I feel like a ghost wandering in a world grown alien. I cannot cast out the old way of writing, and I cannot acquire the new." It's music of grandeur and vigour, shot through with nostalgia. Heard how disparaging Rachmaninoff could be in his remarks about America. But in January 1928, on a visit to Paris, he told his interviewer that New York had become the musical capital of the world. "Year by year, the thing that impresses me more and more about America is the wonderful improvement in public taste and appreciation that's taken place within an astonishingly short period of time. When I first went to America in 1909, audiences were not one-tenth so large and discriminating as they are now. New York," he said, "has replaced Berlin as the bright, particular heart of music, and Philadelphia possesses one of the greatest orchestras the world has ever heard." By this time, Rachmaninoff was well known everywhere, and frequently, with sinking heart, he'd find himself the focus of a photographer's lens. But he would roar with laughter when he recalled an incident on the liner Berengaria on a voyage returning to the US after a concert tour of this country. As he boarded the ship, he saw a whole phalanx of photographers advancing towards him. He braced himself, but then found that they rushed straight by him. He turned round to see that they were aiming not for him, but for the prize fighter Primo Carnera coming up the gangway behind him. His fame was such that he now found himself being paid the slightly dubious compliment of having another composer make orchestrations of his pieces. At the suggestion of the conductor Serge Koussevitzky, Rachmaninoff was asked to select a group of his favourite étude tableaux. We heard a couple of the originals earlier, to be orchestrated by Ottorino Respighi. Rachmaninoff was entirely happy about this and chose five of them. It was now that he offered Respighi explanations of what might be pictured in the tableau. We'll hear Respighi's orchestration of the one which Rachmaninoff said resembled an Oriental march. Rachmaninoff had always been so circumspect since leaving Russia about making any kind of public statement which might have repercussions for his relatives still living in his homeland. But in January 1931, he evidently let his guard slip when he allowed his signature to appear in an article published in the New York Times, which was critical of the Indian writer Rabindranath Tagore, who had praised the achievements of the Soviet Union in the area of public education. Soon after, Rachmaninoff found himself denounced in the Russian press as a violent enemy of Soviet Russia. Thereafter, the Moscow and Leningrad conservatoires issued edicts banning the performance of Rachmaninoff's music. Absurdly, the State Music Publishing House chose this precise moment to issue a new series of Rachmaninoff's piano music. By this time, Rachmaninoff had adopted a pattern of working in the US on a series of concert tours and then resting over the summer in Europe. In the house he built in Switzerland on the shores of Lake Lucerne, he tried to recreate as far as possible the atmosphere of Ivanovka, his lost estate in Russia. And it was while the house was being built that he composed what would be his last solo work for the piano, and the only one he composed after leaving Russia, his Variations on a Theme of Corelli. He wrote to his friend Nikolai Metner, "I've played them about 15 times, but not once have I played them in full. I was guided by the audience's coughing. When the coughing increased, I skipped to the next variation. When there was no coughing, I played them in the proper order. At one concert, the coughing was so violent that I only played 10 variations out of 20. January 1932 saw Rachmaninoff back in the US on a tour of the Midwest, on which he appears to have been in absolutely peak form, and which proved to be nothing short of triumphal. A review of his concert in Chicago told its readers, "With one impulse, the audience rose and shouted its approval. Never have I witnessed such a tribute, not in a symphony, opera, or recital. And never, it is my sincere conviction, has such response been so richly deserved. For the imperishable beauty of this music is added to the spiritual wealth of the world, a solace, a joy to treasure always in grateful memory." When the Rachmaninoffs' house in Switzerland, which they called Senar, was finally complete, and they arrived to take possession of it, they found a magnificent piano installed, a gift from Steinway's. At that piano, in his studio, cocooned in the idyllic atmosphere of the new house, Rachmaninoff even felt able to begin composing again. The new work, for piano and orchestra, was inspired by a violin virtuoso of the past, Niccolo Paganini. Rachmaninoff wrote to his sister-in-law, Sophie Satin, about his Rhapsody on a Theme of Paganini. "I am glad that I have been able to write this piece in the first year of living in the new Senar. It is some compensation for the many stupidities I allowed myself to commit in building Sennar. True, so I think. The theme Rachmaninoff chose was the famous run from the last of Paganini's 24 Caprices. What he does with it in a series of 24 virtuoso variations is a tour de force of tautness and ingenuity. Taking his cue from the legend that Paganini had sold his soul to the devil to achieve perfection in his art, Rachmaninoff combines Paganini's theme with the ancient theme of the plainchant Dies Irae. The Rhapsody was an immediate success. When it was performed in New York by the New York Philharmonic Society, with Bruno Walter conducting, Robert A. Simon wrote in The New Yorker, "The Rhapsody isn't philosophical, significant, or even artistic. It's something for audiences, and what our orchestras need at the moment is more music for audiences. More music for audiences means more audiences for music. And with this sage apothegm, I conclude another salute to Mr. Rachmaninoff." Rachmaninoff's manner on the platform always struck audiences as unusual, a complete absence of anything ingratiating or genial. As one writer observed of a recital he gave in November 1935, "He does not smile once through the whole occasion. In no way does he gesticulate or parade. All that he communicates, he says with two wrists and 10 fingers, without the raising of an eyebrow." Over the summer of 1936, staying at Sennar, Rachmaninoff completed a new symphony, his third. He had written it for his favourite orchestra, the Philadelphia, and their conductor, Leopold Stokowski. They naturally had the honour of the premiere in November 1936. The third symphony is imbued with grand, brooding passion and an epic sweep, and it was seen by many as very Russian in character. Rachmaninoff's sister-in-law, Sofia Satina, said to Rachmaninoff after the first performance, "I have no doubt at all that the symphony is about Russia's history, and that it expresses your own devotion to our beloved country." To which Rachmaninoff's answer was an enigmatic smile. After its premiere in November 1936, the audience applauded enthusiastically. Then it was taken up by all the major American orchestras, but neither audiences nor critics responded to it subsequently with the kind of warmth Rachmaninoff would have wished. He was philosophical about this. "When my first symphony was first played, they said it was so-so. When my second was played, they said the first was good, but the second was so-so. Now that my third has been played, they say that my first and second are good, but that, oh well, you see how it is." On a European tour in February of 1938, Rachmaninoff found himself in Vienna preparing for a performance of The Bells. Here was another case where the noise in the street outside his hotel told him of seismic events. This time it wasn't an armistice, but crowds shouting in favour of Hitler and the Anschluss. All concerts were cancelled. History remorselessly repeated itself as the Rachmaninoff family boarded the Aquitania with blacked-out portholes and once again, with extraordinary good fortune, escaped from war as they had in 1918. There would be no more composing holidays in Switzerland. I imagine every musician dreams of a hit, making it into the big time with a piece which really takes off and which everyone loves, bringing them fame and fortune. But musical history offers us a litany of single pieces which have come to dog their composers' lives, obliterating everything else they wrote and making them seem like one-trick ponies. Ravel abominated the endless versions of his Bolero. Saint-Saëns, I think, would cheerfully have throttled his swan in the Carnival of the Animals. Rachmaninoff felt the same way about his prelude in C-sharp minor, which he composed at the age of 19. He acknowledged it had made his reputation, but it came to be the bane of his life, an absolute necessity in every programme he performed. Audiences expected it, demanded it, whenever he gave a recital. Versions of its 62 bars proliferated around the planet, many of them unspeakable, others unrecognisable. But there was one version Rachmaninoff himself claimed to like, a particularly American version, rather a surprisingly jazzy dance tune version of the Somber Prelude, courtesy of the saxophonist Charlie Barnett and the Charlie Barnett rhythm makers, of which Rachmaninoff said, "I think I prefer it that way." "I wish I had never written it," Rachmaninoff said more than once of his prelude in C-sharp minor. But he was evidently tickled by that upbeat version by saxophone player Charlie Barnett and the Charlie Barnett rhythm makers, which they recorded in May 1938 in New York. Rachmaninoff may even have learned a little from Charlie Barnett, as well as a wrinkle or two from Broadway. In 1940, when he was working on his symphonic dances, he decided he wanted to include a saxophone in the score, and with little experience of the instrument, he consulted the composer Dennis Russell Davis, who'd orchestrated hundreds of Broadway musicals, about which member of the saxophone family might be appropriate. He opted for the alto, as you'll hear shortly. The symphonic dances emerged in the space of little over a month, and they were to be the only piece Rachmaninoff composed entirely in the United States, and his last important work. He intended it for Eugene Ormandy and the Philadelphia Orchestra. He seems to have envisaged that these might literally be dances, and have consulted Fokine over choreographing the three movements. At this stage, they were to be called Noon, Twilight, and Midnight. But that idea was soon abandoned, along with the titles. There's surely a sense in which the symphonic dances are a kind of summation of Rachmaninoff's art, permeated by that sense of sundering from Mother Russia, which is a constant theme in his music. He was certainly looking back over his shoulder as far back as 1915. The watermarks show that some of the music was written on Russian paper. The dances run to a little over half an hour. The first movement has a plangent, nostalgic solo part for the saxophone. Rachmaninoff was nervous about writing for it and had the player from the Philadelphia Orchestra come out to his house for a day and talk him through its peculiarities. Eugene Ormandy invited Rachmaninoff to come along to the rehearsals, and Rachmaninoff addressed the orchestra. "When I was a young man," he told them, "I idolised Shalyapin. He was my ideal. And when I thought of composition, I thought of song and Shalyapin. Now he is gone. Today, when I think of composing, my thoughts turn to you, the greatest orchestra in the world. For that reason, I dedicate this, my newest composition, to the members of the Philadelphia Orchestra and to your conductor, Eugene Ormandy." That was probably my last flicker. That's what Rachmaninoff said of his symphonic dances. It's difficult to believe, given the music's popularity now, but it got an indifferent reception when it was premiered by those performers in January 1941. Part of the explanation may be that Rachmaninoff was working on the orchestration right up to the last minute, and the orchestra had probably not had as much time as it needed to get the music securely under its belt. Though he never returned to Russia after he left in 1918, his homeland was still where his heart lay. Though he was depressed by news of the German invasion of Russia in June 1941, Rachmaninoff refused to be dragged down by the defeatist talk he heard from other Russian émigrés in the US. He tried to find some way to help his native land in these desperate times. He was frustrated that Americans understood so little of Russian geography, let alone the Russian spirit. For a recital he was to give in November, he wanted to have all the advertisements state that the entire receipts would be given to the war sufferers of his native Russia. But he was dissuaded and had to be content with a notice in the programme. He also sent a shipment of $4,000 worth of medical supplies to Russia. At this time, there was at last something of a rapprochement with another key Russian émigré. He and Stravinsky had studiously avoided each other, but now Rachmaninoff put out a feeler to Stravinsky, acknowledging that while he knew his fellow composer respected him as a pianist, he had always disliked Rachmaninoff's music, while Stravinsky must know my attitude to modern music. In fact, Rachmaninoff had always held up the Firebird and Petrushka as works of genius. Both composers were happy to have the barrier come down. Stravinsky came to dinner at the Rachmaninoffs, and the evening went well. The two men discussed at length their anxieties over the safety of the children they both had living in France at the time. Their meeting took place in California in the summer of 1942. Rachmaninoff had only recently moved there from the East Coast. He planted birch trees in the garden of his house in Beverly Hills to remind him of Russia. There was a good deal of anxiety on the West Coast about the war with Japan. One night, the sirens sounded an air raid warning. Rachmaninoff was at a friend's house for dinner. The guests turned out all the lights and sat in the dark singing Russian songs, thinking of the old country. They may have sung some of these, his own songs. Despite living in the USA for many years, Rachmaninoff had been slow to identify himself with his adopted country. But now, in the early weeks of 1943, he and his wife formally became American citizens. One of Rachmaninoff's neighbours in Beverly Hills was his fellow Russian, the pianist Vladimir Horovitz. It was with Horovitz that he paid a visit to the Disney studios. While they were there, Rachmaninoff heard what was surely the ultimate version of his prelude. They were treated to a screening of Disney's early film Mickey's Opry House, in which the tiny hero is seen as a concert pianist playing Rachmaninoff's most famous piece. The composer told Walt Disney, "I have heard my inescapable piece done marvellously by some of the best pianists and murdered cruelly by amateurs. But never was I more stirred than by the performance of the great maestro Mouse." Shortly after moving to Los Angeles, Rachmaninoff went into a studio to make a series of recordings. They would turn out to be his last. There was a valedictory feeling in the air. He was aware he couldn't go on performing in public at the high level that he had set himself, and he found the whole business increasingly draining on his energies. So he decided that the current season should be his last. His doctor approved of his decision. He was suffering from sclerosis and high blood pressure. In the middle of February, on the train on the way to Florida to give a concert, he became so ill they had to take him off and cancel the concert. His family took him home, a marathon of 60 hours. After hospital tests, a press release talked of pneumonia, pleurisy and complications. But what Rachmaninoff actually had was a rare form of racing cancer. By the time a telegram arrived from Moscow announcing celebrations for his 70th birthday, he was in a coma. He died on the 28th of March, a few days short of his birthday. Here's one of those last recordings Rachmaninoff made. It's a piano version of his own song, Lilacs.